Donating blood is something many of us are encouraged to do, but not something all of us can do, not easily anyway. Australia is one of many countries where gay and bisexual men who've had sex with men in the last 3 months are excluded from donating blood. And in many countries, those restrictions are even stronger, in some cases banning people from donating altogether. But in a landmark shift this week in the UK, gay men in sexually active monogamous relationships have been allowed to donate for the first time. Ethan Spybe is one of those men fortunate enough to book his first donation this week. It's something he's been campaigning for more than 6 years, and he joins me now from London. Welcome to Drive.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
What was it like to finally book your spot, get your free tea and bickies, and actually donate blood?
It was weird. It was emotional in a way, because, like you said, it's been, you know, 6 years of campaigning really hard on this. And it was kind of that moment where you realise, you know, this is what this is all about. Because, you know, yes, it's completely ridiculous that gay and bisexual men have been excluded. An entire population, just that potential has just been thrown away from donating blood. But what it's really about is that incredible and very simple act of sat there with a, I think I had a Bourbon biscuit, and donating blood. And that literally goes on to save someone's life. So it felt like a real, real moment. And the shift that's happened here, I think, is a step change, for a more inclusive and fair blood donation policy.
You founded Freedom to Donate and have been campaigning, as you say, for this change for more than 6 years, but it began as a fairly personal plight. Tell me about your grandfather.
Yeah, very. So, they were like a second set of parents to me. So they had their houses literally like 200 meters around the corner. And so whatever I wasn't allowed to do at home, I got to do at their house. So I was really close. And granddad went through a major operation to do with his heart and needed about 8 pints of blood. Before this, we hadn't really donated blood as a family. Mum and dad, I don't think, had. And it's kind of that moment when it happens to you that you're like, wow, you know, if someone hadn't donated blood, granddad wouldn't be alive. So kind of from that moment, Mum and dad made this pact almost and said, you know, we should all donate blood as a family and pay back that donor who saved his life. And then it was only when dad brought home the kind of forms and the questions about, you know, whether you're able to donate blood, that I realized that as a gay man, I was, you know, I was ineligible to donate. I was also not out to my parents at the time too. So I think I ran upstairs and made an excuse about needles. But it was kind of that real, I don't know, I felt like guilt and shame looking down those questions when I realized that I couldn't do the one thing that someone else had done to save my granddad's life.
The UK has switched to an individualised gender-neutral risk assessment model. What does that actually mean?
Exactly. So not to clarify the kind of title, but it's not about monogamy. It's about sexual activity and types of sexual activity and how often you've had it and how many times it's happened in the last 3 months. So to be clearer about that, and don't want to kind of, you know, go into the specifics too much, but it's essentially asking anyone and everyone for the very first time how many people they've had sex with and how they've had sex with them. And you don't have to have sex with one person to be able to donate. So that's really important because sexual activities dependent on what you do with how many people carry a certain amount of risk. And that's an objective measure of risk about how bloodborne viruses can be transmitted. So for the very first time, what we're saying is regardless of whether you're straight or gay, the sexual activity that you have carries a risk factor with it, which is an objective fact. And your eligibility to donate is solely based on your answers to those questions. No longer are you assumed too risky because you're a gay or bisexual man who's had sex in the last few months. And the reason that's important and the kind of illustration of this is previously, if you were straight, you could have sex with as many people as you wanted, you know, hundreds if you were lucky enough to do so, and then still go and donate blood, you know, essentially the next day. If you were gay or bisexual and you just had one, you know, sex with one person in the last few months, you were completely barred from doing so. So this is a real step change, which means anyone and everyone is assessed solely on the basis of that sexual activity. And we think that's a fantastic thing to make a more inclusive and fairer policy and ultimately a safer and more sufficient supply of blood for everyone.
Ethan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
And that's Ethan Spybee, the founder of the Freedom to Donate. And this week, for the first time, he was able to donate blood in the UK. So what is the situation in Australia and could it change? The Kirby Institute's professor, John Kaldor, has contributed to reviews of Australia's deferral rules for blood donation and joins me now. Welcome to RN Drive.
Thanks very much.
Will Australian experts be watching the UK to see how this shift plays out? How much can we glean from their experience?
Well, the processes of assessing risk in the blood supply draw upon local information and certainly draw upon experiences internationally. And the blood agencies around the world all talk to each other and they're very much aware of what each other is doing and do try to learn from best practice that they can find elsewhere.
How does Australia's donation system work and what is the purpose of having a three-month deferral period for gay and bisexual men?
Yeah, so Australia has an extremely low risk blood supply in terms of the potential for transmission of blood-borne infections. And that's been established through both the deferral system and the screening for different infections. Back in the 80s, when HIV first appeared, there were a number of deferrals that were essentially lifetime deferrals imposed. And then gradually, as the testing became more reliable and the blood services became more confident about the ability to detect infections, they introduced shorter deferral periods. Until recently, we've had a one-year deferral for people who are considered to have a sexual risk. And the question has always been, well, why can't you reduce it to a much shorter time period? Because our tests are actually very good at detecting infections. So why do you need to have these deferral periods that are so lengthy? Which is true, except the tests are not 100% perfect when it comes to very recent infections. And so the tests do miss infections that are HIV infections that are in the first few weeks. And they may miss hepatitis B infections that are maybe up to about a month. And so the deferral adds an extra safety net over and above that, an extra cushion of safety on the grounds that people aren't necessarily sure about when their most recent episode of risk might have been within the last few weeks.
Australia previously, as you say, had a one-year deferral period. This year that changed to that three-month waiting period. What changed to allow that?
There have been attempts to change, to reduce the deferral period for some time. In fact, the first submission from Lifeblood, or what was then the Red Cross Blood Transfusion Service, was almost 10 years ago, and it was a proposal to reduce it to 6 months, and that was rejected by the Therapeutic Goods Administration, largely at that time because there was a bit of a resurgence of HIV infection, and there was a concern that they might be introducing more risk into the system. The testing hasn't really, testing has always improved, but the main advances in testing had already happened by then. So really what's happened is greater confidence in the whole process of both interviewing but also testing and making sure that infections are likely to be picked up and that the only thing you have to do is reduce that so-called window period where recent infections may be missed.
HIV numbers have been in decline since 2014. Does this present an opportunity to change donation restrictions and what more is needed to follow the UK's lead on this individualised gender-neutral risk assessment process?
Yeah, I mean, each country has to look at its own risk profile and settings. In Australia, even though, as you say, infection rates have gone down, it's still the case that by far the majority of HIV infections in the Australian community are transmitted through male-to-male sex. And that means that it does make sense if you are trying to establish a deferral process that you focus on where the risk is greatest. And it's not just, as I said, not just gay men, but it's also people who are sexual partners or who are from countries of high HIV prevalence. And the process of individual risk assessment may be considered to work in the UK is not necessarily the one that will be most relevant to Australia. We have to look at our own setting and look at the process of risk assessment in that environment. I think your previous guest from the UK made a point about different sexual behaviours, whether it's if the person who's heterosexual may have multiple sexual partners over an extended time period, and yet if a gay man just has one sexual partner, they would be excluded under the previous rules. But the reality is that based on the best information we have in the Australian setting, having multiple heterosexual partners is actually indeed far less risky for HIV acquisition than having even a small number of male-to-male sexual partners. So it's a statistical fact that the risk is definitely higher for gay men acquiring HIV.
Thanks so much for joining us.
No worries.
John Kaldor is a professor at the University of New South Wales's Kirby Institute, and this is RN Drive.